And now let's return to China. The other day we did a sort of counterintuitive story on how Beijing is actually supporting an increase in religious activity for their own sinister reasons. And on this occasion, we're going to be looking at how Beijing is not too happy about any hint of the rise of feminism. 4 years ago, on the eve of International Women's Day, the Chinese government arrested 5 young female activists and held them in a Beijing detention centre for 37 days. Now, prior to their arrest, the women were virtual unknowns, but their incarceration sparked an international outcry from world leaders and kicked off a social media storm. The campaign to free them went viral, and the 5 young women became a cause célèbre, catapulting to overnight fame as the Feminist Five. Now, the event, says our next guest, author Lei Tang Hong Fincher, was a transformative moment in the history of women's rights in China. Lei is a Chinese-American journalist, academic, and she's based in New York, written for umpteen publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian. Lei was on our Little Wireless program back in 2014 to chat about her first book, Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China. In her second, Betraying Big Brother, she returns to the subject of gender in China, this time charting the rise of feminist activism. And the case of the Feminist Five, she says, has prompted an unprecedented awakening among China's educated urban women, and the movement has the potential to be as big as the pro-democracy uprising of 1989. Could that be true? Lei joins me now from her home in New York. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
As a Chinese-American journalist based in New York, how did you find the Feminist Five?
I've only been based in New York for 2 years. I was based in Beijing doing my PhD, which I received in 2014. And I actually met one of the Feminist Five before she became really famous, Li Maizi. And I wrote about her a tiny bit in my first book. So I had already known her. And then in March of 2015, when these 5 young women were arrested, I mean, I was incredibly worried. Of course, I mean, it was alarming that these 5 young women were jailed just for planning to hand out anti-sexual harassment stickers on subways and buses.
But let's walk this back a bit, right, because she's such an interesting woman. And you, having met her at a party at the Feminist Voices office in Beijing, you discovered that she was standing outside a courtroom during legal proceedings wearing a wedding dress stained with fake blood.
That's right. I didn't see her when she was doing that. I met her at a party afterwards, but she'd been involved in some protests, such as supporting the case of this American woman, Kim Lee, who was divorcing her abusive husband, and this case, the legal case that Kim Lee filed against her husband, Li Yang, who was a celebrity English teacher in China. It became a legal milestone and kind of paved the way for the passage of the anti-domestic violence law in China in 2016. So Li Maizi was standing outside the courtroom, you know, wearing this white wedding gown and a big sign supporting the passage of an anti-domestic violence law. She was also involved in some other activist, protests or performance art, as they prefer to call it. So I met her in 2013. And I'd talked to her a few times, and she was very charismatic even back then. Of course, I was very worried about her and the other women when they were jailed in 2015.
Let the record show, dear listener, that Lei has interviewed all of the Feminist Five. You say their activism has helped pave the way for a Chinese version of Me Too, but before we talk about that, tell us a little about the other four women involved. Let's meet them.
Sure. Well, before I introduce you, I have to emphasize that these women were kind of randomly jailed, so they weren't actual leaders of any particular movement at the time. But Li Maizi was one of those who was jailed, and she's a queer feminist activist. Another one was Wei Tingting, who was also a queer feminist activist. And she, a couple of years ago after they were released from jail, she managed to start an anti-sexual violence center in Guangzhou that was very active. But then it was only recently shut down again. There was another woman named Wu Rongrong who headed up a new women's rights center in Hangzhou, a different city from the others, and she was probably the most veteran of all of the feminist activists who were detained, and she was the only one who was married and had a child at the time as well. One of the women was Wang Men, who was in Beijing, and she's primarily a feminist scholar, actually. She wasn't even that much of a political activist. And then the last one was Zheng Chuan, who's also known as by the nickname Giant Rabbit, and she is based in Guangzhou. So the Feminist Five were located in three different cities. But actually, when the police carried out this round of arrests in 2015, they initially arrested it's hard to say a total how many activists were arrested, but at least 10 feminists were arrested, and then they ended up focusing on these five young women and bringing them all to the same detention center in Beijing. And that's when they became known as the Feminist Five.
Later, you give a harrowing account of the treatment of these women during their incarceration in Beijing.
Well, it was harrowing for all of them. And in fact, I couldn't even go into some of the most harrowing details in the book because the five of them are, you know, they're still young, they're still technically criminal suspects, and they're still at risk. But even so, the descriptions that they gave me and they were willing to go public with are very disturbing.
Let me just at least hint at them, apart from constant interrogation, sleep deprivation, woken up at night to scrub floors, and threats of rape. Doesn't get much more unpleasant than that.
Well, it was extremely unpleasant. That's very true. Another thing that was really striking was that one of the very first things that the security agents did when they detained all five of the women was four of the women wore glasses, and the security agents confiscated the glasses of those four women, and one of them was basically blind without her glasses. And so that was a way, a very powerful way to completely disorient the women during their entire period of detention.
Later, you also point out that the families are threatened, and you write, Chinese state security agents penetrated deep into their family networks with a brutal efficiency reminiscent of the Stasi.
Yes, and this is one of the most disturbing aspects of the methods used by China's security apparatus today, because a lot of the activists are very young, they're extremely bold and courageous, and they're not easily daunted when they're intimidated by these security agents. And so in recent years, security apparatus in China has focused more and more on also harassing and even detaining the family members of troublemakers. So it's become almost routine practice for security agents to go and search for the parents of young activists and enlist the parents even in trying to get their you know, in this case, it was the feminist activists, and get their daughters under control. But this is not, you know, a technique confined to the treatment of feminist activists. This is just commonly used now.
Well, as you point out, any grassroots group that seems to be organized and is actually making strides in its efforts to mobilize people is going to be seen as a threat. Any group.
Yes, basically, and particularly under the new president, Xi Jinping, there's been a much more aggressive assault on civil society in general. And so there's a shrinking space for any kind of social movement of any or protests. But that to me is what is so striking about this women's rights movement, is that even as the space is shrinking for civil society overall, that this women's rights movement has, in spite of all these obstacles and incredible barriers, that has actually managed to grow since 2015. And that is really remarkable to me.
Let's look at one of the barriers. The internet has played a huge part in China's feminist awakening, despite the fact that it's locked behind a great firewall. So the women have been imaginative in getting around internet censorship.
Yes, I mean, this is one thing that is, I just think, is incredible, because the government, Chinese government controls on the internet are becoming even more aggressive and sophisticated. They're becoming so sophisticated that they're able to recognize images, for example. But in spite of this increasing aggressive interference and surveillance of the internet in China, these activists are very creative. They find ways to get around the censorship. For example, when the Me Too hashtag was heavily censored, there were waves of censorship. So it wasn't entirely blocked out. But there were waves of censorship where the hashtag Me Too couldn't get through. And one young feminist came up with the idea of using emojis for Me Too, which sounds like Me Too, but is actually in Chinese means rice and bunny rabbit. So she used the emoji for a rice bowl and a bunny rabbit to get around the censorship of the Me Too hashtag. But of course, the censors after a while caught on to that. But that's just one example of how these activists are constantly using their ingenuity to, you know, even if only briefly, to outwit the internet censors.
Being twice your age, I remember a time when Mao Zedong said that women hold up half the sky. And in fact, there was constitutional recognition of the equality of women.
Yes, well, in fact, the Constitution of the People's Republic today still has, you know, gender equality written into it. It certainly hasn't been overturned. But gender equality was a founding principle of the People's Republic when the communists won the revolution in 1949. And throughout the whole early communist era, the rhetoric was very strongly pro-women's and men's equality. You know, the propaganda upheld these very robust images of women doing jobs that were traditionally masculine, such as, you know, driving bulldozers or being welders. And the Communist Party also mobilized women in the workforce and assigned them en masse to jobs in the cities and in the countryside. So China had probably the world's most, the highest rate of female labor force participation in the world. But then all of that has gradually been undone over the last few decades with the onset of market reforms. And particularly over the last 10 years and even more under President Xi Jinping, there's just been this complete reversal in rhetoric. And now the emphasis by the government is to push women into these very traditional roles of wife and mother. and to push especially educated women into getting married before they turn 30 and having babies as quickly as they can. So it's a complete change in policy and rhetoric coming from the Chinese government.
I learned from you later an extraordinary fact that this patriarchal authoritarianism is reflected in the state media describing the president as a big daddy.
Well, Xi Jinping, for the first few years as the supreme ruler, was known as Xi Dada, which I think can roughly be translated as Big Daddy Xi. And this personality cult that surrounds Xi Jinping is really intense, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Mao era decades ago. But I write about how it's also a very hyper-masculine personality cult. So, for example, you know, there's this popular culture. There were a lot of these hip-hop videos that were put out talking about how, you know, Xi Jinping or Xi Dada is the kind of man you should marry. If you want to marry a man like Xi Dada, for example.
At least he doesn't take his shirt off like Putin.
Well, no, no, he hasn't done that in reality. But it is kind of interesting to see the parallels in that hyper-masculine personality cult around Putin as well, and other, I would say, misogynistic dictators globally. But that's one thing that I think patriarchal authoritarianism is really key to the Chinese government's efforts to control the entire population, that they really want everybody to play their supposed correct role in the social hierarchy and in families in particular. And so this new emphasis in recent years on getting women to return to, quote unquote, their proper role in the home, where they are taking care of the family, they're doing the housework, they're having babies.
Well,
you know,
hang on. Well, let's just stop there for a second. Having babies, perhaps that's a part of it, because, of course, it's only comparatively recently that the regulation regarding one child was lifted, and China must see itself as having a bit of a population problem.
Yeah, well, exactly. So for over 35 years, the Chinese government practiced the so-called one-child policy, which was notorious for a lot of its human rights abuses, you know, often forcing women to have abortions or forcing them to insert IUDs en masse. But then all of a sudden, at the beginning of 2016, the Chinese government just abandoned that and then adopted a new official two-child policy. And then the propaganda completely changed. And almost overnight started urging especially educated urban women to hurry up and have two babies for the glory of the nation. And so this is one of the big flashpoints now in China, is that the government is trying to get young, especially urban educated women, into marrying and having babies. But young women in China really don't want that anymore. And so you can see that in the birth of this new feminist movement. But even aside from the political activism, you just look at the statistics, the birth statistics, in spite of this reversal of policy, the births are still continuing to fall really dramatically in just the last couple of years.
We're almost out of time, but I'd like you to explain to me the notion of, what is it, consumer feminism?
Well, I mean, I would say consumer feminism is something that we're very used to in places like the United States or Australia, where feminism is used as a brand. And it's kind of cool. A lot of corporations adopt the term to sell products. This is a really taken off in China, too. And it's rather interesting to observe, because the Chinese government is cracking down on political feminist activism and persecuting these individual feminist activists. But a lot of corporations are picking up on the fact that young women in China really crave alternative ways of living. They want more freedom and, you know, independence for themselves. And so you see corporations using the notion of women's empowerment in their advertising and being very successful. And you can see it in popular culture as too, like androgynous groups. I give an example of a band called A Crush, which is five young women who present themselves as being gender fluid or, you know, very much like a boy band. And those kinds of images, alternative forms of sexuality, alternative lifestyles, those are the things that a lot that young women really want in China today.
Later, a final question. What has the feminist movement managed to achieve thus far?
Well, I mean, I think it's almost a miracle that this women's rights movement is still surviving in the face of this just brutal onslaught from the government in so many different ways since 2015 and the jailing of the Feminist Five. So the government has tried to wipe out this movement, but it has not succeeded. And in fact, not only has it not succeeded, but more and more young women are actually speaking out and demanding rights for themselves. And it's gotten to the point where, particularly last year, you know, when Me Too started to take off in China, in spite of the internet censorship, where you just see, you know, ordinary women just across the country in cities everywhere, just springing up out of nowhere to take a leading role in demanding you know, more rights, such as the freedom, you know, the right to be free from getting sexually harassed by your professor at your university. So it's very difficult for the government to completely quash this movement. And I think we're going to see this confrontation, you know, between young women in China increasingly standing up for themselves, wanting more for themselves, and then the Chinese government trying to push them down, push them into these subservient roles.
It's good to talk to you again later. Leda Hongfincher, journalist and academic based in New York, her new book, Betraying Big Brother, The Feminist Awakening in China. It's published by Verso, and incidentally, later we'll be speaking here next month. You will be able to catch her at the All About Women Festival at the Opera House. That's on the 10th of March, so pop that in your diary as a must-attend. Coming up, the quest to save the world's biggest butterfly.